This is Bill McClure for the Triangle Radio Reading Service, and welcome to another edition of Take My Arm.
This is Richard Dunnigan. This program is intended for a print and visually impaired audience and is prepared with the assistance of print and visually impaired volunteers.
And this is Bob Martin. And I came across the most amazing show that was on television back in 2005.
Let me guess. Was that the year that Desperate Housewives started?
Or maybe Survivor?
No, more important than those.
American Idol?
Much better. And it only lasted half a season.
Well, it couldn't have been such a great program if it only lasted half a season.
Well, maybe not. But it was important.
What was it?
It was called Blind Justice.
Was it really about a blind person?
Yes, it was. And you will never guess what this blind man did for a living.
He was a piano tuner.
I don't think so. He was pretty talented, but the program didn't say what he did in his spare time.
I think Bill's just kidding about that. Let's see. With your interest in Dr. Jacob Bulletin, the first totally blind man to become a doctor in the United States, I'll guess a doctor.
Good guess. But from our opening program, he was a cop.
An out-on-the-street police officer?
Yep. In the pilot episode, he is shot in the head and refuses to be confined to an office job. So, he's out on the street doing his job.
Did any blind people review this program?
Well, yes, they did.
And?
And they found it was pretty accurate portrayal of how a blind person lives. They especially cited the proper commands that were given to the guide dog that he used. And when he walked with his partner, she offered him her arm. And they said, "Well done."
Anything negative?
Well, just one thing. He still carried a gun.
And they didn't think that was very realistic?
I guess not. It was only on for half a season.
You know something, Bob? That wasn't the first film portrayal of someone blind with a gun.
That's right. About 10 years before, a film was made that was also entitled Blind Justice. It was about a soldier blinded in the Civil War, and he's traveling through Mexico, and he still used his gun.
I know. He came down from around Turkey Otter Creek. He and the kid across the creek were both blind, and they could hit a canteen just from the sound.
That was our story about two boys that were born blind. In this movie, the soldier is injured in the war.
Okay. So that was someone else's story. But the point was the same.
That's right. Better than you ever might have expected. And we can do it without the gun.
You know, Bob, that about 250 years before the TV series and the movie, there was a blind police officer in London.
That's right. His name was Sir John Fielding.
And the British police don't carry guns.
That's right. Sir John had been blinded by an accident when he was 19 while serving in the Navy. He went on to form his own business and read law with his older half-brother, Thomas Fielding, the author, and eventually became a magistrate.
With his brother, they founded London's first police force, the Bow Street Runners. They also developed a set of record-keeping for the justice system and began the publication of a police gazette, which printed police activity and the names of convicted criminals.
When his brother died, Sir John became the chief magistrate. Today's equivalent would have been like a chief of police. It was estimated that he could identify over 3,000 criminals just from the sound of their voices.
Hey, not bad for someone who was completely blind.
Though not yet on audiobook, author Bruce Alexander has written a series of novels about the exploits of the so-called Blind Beak. Fiction, but based on actual events from the life and work of a totally blind policeman, Sir John Fielding.
I read one of those novels, and it was entitled Blind Justice. Pretty amazing.
Speaking of amazing, this is a pretty good spot to introduce our guest today. He is Ed Summers, a member of the board here at TRRS.
Ed is an employee of SAS Institute. Ed, welcome to Take My Arm.
Thank you, Bill.
Tell us about yourself.
Well, recently turned 40 years old, and I'm from Cary, North Carolina. I have two small boys. They're 6 and 7, and I'm married, and I work at SAS Institute there in Cary, and I'm active here with TRRS and Foundation Fighting Blindness.
Tell us about your education.
I was raised in Cary, so I went through the Cary schools and Cary High School, and I went to college down at University of North Carolina at Wilmington for my undergraduate, and I did a little bit of graduate work at North Carolina State University here in Raleigh.
When did you discover that you were losing your vision?
Bill, when I was 10 years old, I was playing Little League Baseball at Mills Field in Cary, up by Cary Town Center. It was a spring night, and it was getting dark, and they hadn't turned on the lights yet, and it was a dirty ball because, you know, how it is in Little League, you use that ball long past the time you should. A ball came in to first base, and it bounced off my glove and hit the dirt. The dirty ball blended in with that dirty infield, and I just couldn't find it to save my life. The runners on base ran in, and the pitcher had to come over and pick up the ball because I never did find it. After that, my parents took me over to Duke Hospital, Duke and Chapel Hill, both of them. We figured out that it was retinitis pigmentosa, and I've been losing my vision for about 30 years, and it's almost gone. There's not too much left.
Do you have some functional vision left, some usable vision?
Yeah, I have, as far as my field goes, I have 2 or 3 degrees. I have 20/250 in the best of situations. I had cataracts about... I had them taken out about 10 years ago, but I had cataracts that developed, so they removed my cataracts and put in some, you know, acrylic lenses, which is my correction. So at this point, I don't have to wear glasses, and it's great.
Okay.
Just, you know, no glasses, no glasses.
One less thing to lose.
That's exactly right.
Absolutely. What challenges did that present to you as you continued your education in public school and on through college?
Well, I was lucky enough to get through school being able to read, you know, using print and to see the blackboard most of the time as long as I sat in front. The biggest problems that I had, you know, coming through school were coming in outside, you know, from outside during the day and coming into a dark hallway. I couldn't see a thing because my eyes didn't adjust to the dark. You know, going to the school dance was a big problem. Being able to do all those kinds of social things. Needless to say, you know, my baseball career ended pretty soon after I learned that I had RP, along with basketball and football and all the other sports I was playing at the time. So I switched up to swimming, and I started running. I joined the track team, and I started playing golf. Got pretty good at golf until I got busy with other things in my teenage years.
You've done a lot of things that have helped you adapt to whatever your situation is.
I spent way too much time whining about the things I couldn't do because of RP. You know, it's tough. Lose the ability to do the things that you love doing, but I've gotten pretty good at finding new things that I love doing that I didn't know that I loved doing beforehand. I stay incredibly busy with everything that's going on, that we have going on between, you know, family and work. And I love to read. I love to read now. And I've always loved to read. And that's one thing you can do really, really well, you know, typically with technology, assistive technology, once you learn how to use it. So, you know, I found all kinds of other productive things that fill my time.
Ed, as you've traveled along your life journey, can you tell us sort of a chronology of how you lost your vision and what you had to do to adapt to that loss as you were losing it?
Sure. The first sign that I was losing vision was when I was about 10 years old. And there were several years where it was just knowledge. It didn't really affect me too much on a day-to-day basis. But that started changing in my mid-teenage years. When I was going through school, I could read okay. But looking back, I know that some vision loss played a role in the fact that I couldn't read very fast or I couldn't read very well, you know, very effectively. In college, I had to adapt to this question of mobility. You know, I didn't have a driver's license, so I had to get around. And I was actually riding a bicycle everywhere I went. You know, I couldn't see good enough to drive, but I could see good enough to get on a bike and ride it. So I did that. When I was in college in Wilmington, I would commute by bike from the campus out about 5 miles from downtown all the way to downtown. Because I was working as a co-op at that time with the United States Army Corps of Engineers. So I would ride my bike down there and work and go back to class. I really started having problems seeing the computer screen in my late 20s. And by that time, you know, I was out of college and I was working at SAS and then at another company called EMC for a little while. And during that period when I was in my 20s, I started having to change the display on my computer screen at work so that I could change the colors, you know, and make the font a little bigger to match my needs. Since I have RP, it helps me to turn the text white and turn the background black. So whenever I started using a new computer, I would go in and find all those settings and, you know, make those changes so it was a little easier to read. There was a night in early 2002, and I was at work. I was working late one night, and I'd been having all kinds of trouble with my vision. It just kept going downhill. It was about 6:30 or 7 o'clock at night, and I was working late, and I got to that point where my vision was crossing, you know how it is when you get tired, or that's how I was when I get tired. And I just, there come a point when I just couldn't see the screen anymore. I could not get my eyes to focus on the letters on the screen to read. That was my lowest point as far as vision goes, because I'd been resisting dealing with RP and learning how to adapt well. And I'd just been doing the little bit it required to get by. And from that point forward, there were some tough times there around 2002. You know, I lost so much vision, and I was forced to go find ways to adapt. Because if I didn't adapt, I just couldn't work. I couldn't continue to enjoy the professional success that I'd had to that time. You know, and I had a mortgage, and I was married, and I wanted to have kids, and I wanted to do all these things, and I had to figure out how to make it happen. So at that time, I reached out into our local community here in Raleigh and found some people who were visually impaired that could help me learn the tools of the trade. You know, and some of those people were Jim DeBrule, Karen Clark, Jonna Simmons from RLCB. People like that here in the local community helped me figure out how to find the resources I need to get productive again. And I worked real hard at that for about 5 years, from learning how to use a cane. Sharon Smith, down at the, she was my rehab person, my O&M instructor. She helped me learn how to use a cane and get around. Greg Brindleson, he helped me find some magnification equipment and things like that. And I did an awful lot of work on my own, trying different kinds of technologies. And it took me about 5 years to learn how to be productive again, really productive, you know, really, really well, like I was back in my mid-20s.
So do you think now that you're as productive as you were in your mid-20s?
Bill, I am more productive than I've ever been in my entire life. It just keeps getting better. Part of that is because I'm determined about it and I work at it all the time. But the other part is, you know, the assistive technology is getting so good now. And after you work, it's a huge learning curve to learn assistive technology. But once you do, it gets better and better and faster and opens up, you know, more opportunities.
Well, tell us, Ed, about your work with SAS Institute.
I lead the SAS Accessibility Tribe, and I call it a tribe, because in order for SAS to make products that are accessible for people with disabilities, it takes a little bit of effort from a lot of people across the organization. The mission of the SAS Accessibility Tribe is to help people succeed using SAS software, and that's people of all abilities. We're having various amounts of success with that because it does take time to enhance software to adapt to assistive technologies. But we're having a lot of good success, and we're breaking new ground and doing some cutting-edge research. We are in the process of making charts and graphs and maps and other types of data visualizations accessible for people without vision. That's, in my opinion, is the new frontier for accessibility. You know, it's been 10 years since I've been able to read a map. Like, I was in D.C. a couple weeks ago for a conference, and it just frustrates me to no end that I can't find a map of D.C. easily and read it. And that's one of the problems we're trying to solve. Because SAS software is great at mapping. We ship maps of the entire world with our software, and our customers use those maps to overlay their business data on top of the map. So, for example, Walmart may show a map of North Carolina, and they may show sales figures for each county of that map of North Carolina, and that's something you can do really easy with SAS software. It's also possible for our customers to import their own custom maps, that say a floor plan of a Walmart or something like that.
Tell us what types of adaptive technology you use.
Everything I can get my hands on. I use JAWS. I use JAWS probably 10 hours a day for my own personal use, or most of it through work, obviously. You know, I crank my JAWS up to about 500 words a minute. I listen to it so much that I just take it up as fast as I can. There's so much to do. You know, there's so much work to do.
I'm fascinated with your career path at SAS. How many different types of jobs have you had with SAS?
I started working at SAS as a co-op when I was in high school. This is my senior year of high school, and Cary High had a program that would allow you to work in the morning and then leave school at noon and do a co-op somewhere. So I was able to get a job at SAS back then, and I was actually working in the shipping and receiving area. And I went off to college there and got a degree in computer science and mathematics, and I came back and started working in research and development at SAS in 1994. And I came into a group at SAS that it's called the Source Management Group, and they help the R&D development groups get product out the door through tools and processes. Over the years, I've had probably 8 different jobs in, you know, within R&D organizations. There's a thing in computer science called compilers, and when you write source code, you have to compile that down into the machine language that the machine can understand. So I spent a couple of years working on compilers at SAS, and then I worked on HP 64-bit hardware for a couple of years. I ported the SAS product over to the relatively new 64-bit hardware that Hewlett-Packard put out.
Tell us how you came to specialize in the accessibility section.
Well, in 2005, I started managing a development team in the publications group in R&D at SAS. At that time, I was working with the person leading the accessibility team because I was one of the few people at SAS who had a disability. And when they needed user input or had some kind of hard problems, you know, regarding how JAWS might work or something like that, they would come ask me, and I would work with them part-time to debug customer problems and things like that. And last year, the person who was leading the accessibility team decided to move to a different role in marketing. So they asked me to lead the team because I do have 20 years of experience as a software developer, and being a person with a disability is a huge plus when you're doing this kind of work, accessibility work.
Do you do a lot of traveling in your work?
Yes, I do. Part of my job is to represent SAS externally with our customers and within the industry. I was in D.C. 2 weeks ago. Back in July, I was in Seattle. In June, I was in Atlanta. And before that, in March, I was in San Diego.
What technologies do you use to assist you when you travel?
Bill, back in 2008, I hung up my cane and I went to the CNI and got my first CNI dog. And his name is Willie, and he's about an 80-pound German Shepherd. And Willie and I go almost everywhere together.
Ed, I understand that you're active with the Foundation Fighting Blindness. Can you tell us more about this organization?
The Foundation Fighting Blindness is the leading organization that is researching cures and treatments for degenerative retinal diseases. It was created back in 1971 by a guy named Gordon Gunn that has RP. But Gordon created this organization in 1971 because he had RP and there was no work being done on it at the time. And in the last 40 years, the Foundation Fighting Blindness has just funded some awesome work. I became active in the organization in 2005. I helped form the Raleigh-Durham chapter here in RTP. And at that time, the foundation was seeking to increase their funding capacity because they had so many great research projects that they did not have funds for. So the idea was to create lots of chapters across the nation that would allow people in our communities to contribute to the research project that are curing these diseases.
How many members do you have in the local chapter?
Well, we define a member as somebody who comes out and participates in our Vision Walk, which is our signature fundraising program. We have one a year here in Raleigh in June. Or people who come out to our chapter meetings to get information about degenerative retinal diseases and the research that's going on. I believe last year at Vision Walk we had about 300 or 400 people, and at our typical chapter meeting we'll have somewhere around 30 or 40 people.
Are most of your members blind, or some of them just normally sighted who have an interest in conditions of blindness?
Just about everybody involved with FFB either has a degenerative retinal disease or a family member or a loved one has a degenerative retinal disease. You know, there are 10 million people in the United States that have macular degeneration, and that is the leading cause of blindness among adults in this country. And, you know, the disease that I have, RP, there's only about 300,000 people in the United States who have that. Macular degeneration is one of the biggest causes of blindness, and we get a lot of people who become involved because of that. The foundation funded some research that eventually turned into the Genentech treatment for AMD, and there's an awful lot of people who are benefiting from that treatment today.
Ed, thank you for being our guest on Take My Arm today.
Thank you, Bill. I've really enjoyed it.
It's time again for the TRRS Theater on the Air with Bill McClure and Abby Lewis with another episode of
Blind Justice.
The scene opens back at the retirement home on visiting day, and Abby is with her grandfather.
Grandpa, it was so much fun. It was my very first sleepover, and all my friends were there.
And what do you do at a sleepover?
Best of all, we stayed up late. We had games that we played and listened to our favorite bands.
Like Frank Sinatra?
Who?
Never mind. Sleepover bands change. What else did you do?
We ate. Grandpa, this is a secret. But in spite of the dog eating off your plate that one time, my mom is the best cook.
What made her so good?
All of my friends raved about everything she served. That proves she's great.
Yes, it does. And she stayed right there with you all the time.
No, that would have been awful. She brought in all these things and then left.
Went away forever.
Grandpa, she just went back to the kitchen.
In case you needed something else.
I told you she was a great mom, but that's a secret.
Of course. You don't want her to think she's that good. What would your friends say?
Oh, Grandpa, it's a sleepover, and they thought she was great.
And then what did you do?
Laughed and screamed a lot.
What did you scream about?
Everything. The games, the music, and Mom's food especially. It's just what you do, but...
But what, Abby?
There was one time we all screamed, and we meant it.
What happened?
Well, it was late at night, and all of a sudden, someone turned out the lights.
And you all laughed?
No, Grandpa. We screamed. It was dark, and we couldn't see anything. I couldn't see where it was or where any of the furniture was. I ran to my friends before I knew where they were. I even stepped on the cat.
And that surprised you?
Yes. But I think not as much as it surprised the cat.
Cats are like that when you step on them.
And for a moment, I was scared. I knew that it was just my friends in the room, and my mom was close by. But when the lights went out, I was scared.
And you thought about being scared the rest of the night?
No, I thought about you. Grandpa, are you scared of the dark?
When I was younger, I used to imagine all kinds of things that were out to get me.
What about now?
No, not anymore.
But aren't things dark for you all the time?
Abby, I don't know what dark is.
It's like when you turn out all the lights at night.
I don't know what light is. Abby, some blind people used to be able to see and then lost their sight. They know about light and dark. For me, it's like having a lamp that has never been plugged in. This may sound funny to you, but you have to know what light is before you can understand what dark is. I have always been blind. I don't know it any other way.
There is no light or dark?
No, Abby, not for me.
What about other colors?
I don't know any colors.
So, when I draw pictures for you and tell you about the green grass and the blue skies and the red and white lights on the Christmas tree, you don't know what that means?
Abby, I can feel sunlight, and when the breeze is blowing, I know when it's coming from a backyard barbecue and when it's coming over a freshly mown lawn. I can experience a whole new world after a rain and have licked little drops of water off a blade of grass. I know when I'm at the seashore and can hear the waves lapping up on the shore and can smell the salt air and seaweed along the beach. I can't see the colors, but I know the experience of them. So please don't stop drawing me pictures.
I've never thought of it before, Grandpa. But you don't know what my dress looks like, or the color of my hair.
It doesn't make any difference to me, Abby. Whatever you wear, or what the color of your hair is, to me you're the prettiest girl in the world.
Grandpa, if you can't see me, how do you know I'm pretty?
There, Abby, is one of the differences between blind people and sighted people. If you can see things, you tend to make decisions from appearances. Some things look good, and some look bad. And later, you might find out that your first appearances were very wrong. The same thing happens with people.
But you can't see things.
Remember Pink Baby?
Yeah.
How does she look today?
Pretty shabby.
Maybe on the outside.
Yeah, to some people, she may look worn out. But to me, she's still special.
So appearances don't always mean a lot, do they?
Not really.
Or for me. I have to see things as they are on the inside. How people are, what they care for, and I can tell all of that about people just by walking with them.
You can?
Hop up a minute. Now, take me over to my dresser, the brown one.
But you can't tell the difference.
But you can.
Yeah, I can. Okay, the brown dresser. Here we are.
Thank you. Now, what happened coming from the chair to the brown dresser?
Well, you took my arm.
You didn't grab mine and push or pull me.
Some people would, but you know the way. You just need a little help.
And you did that. And then?
I led you to the dresser.
By going around behind the chair.
There was a little more room that way, and I didn't want you to run into anything.
And I didn't.
And then we came to the dresser. the brown one.
But along the way, you paused and took your foot and pushed my old shoes out of the way, the black ones.
Was that all right? I didn't want you to trip.
All the little things you did, from the chair to the dresser, the brown one, and why you did them, and that makes you pretty.
To you, Grandpa.
To anyone who looks at what a person is really like, and not just what they might look like. Now, open the third drawer down.
But, Grandpa, Mom says we shouldn't go through other people's things.
And she's right. But in this case, I want you to. Okay. What do you see?
My pictures. All the pictures I've ever drawn.
And what is at the bottom of every picture?
You've written something in Braille. What does it say?
It's the way you described the picture the day you gave it to me.
And here's your favorite poem. I drew a special picture for that.
Yes, you did. I can see your picture every time I read the poem.
Grandpa, will you read your poem to me again? And this time, let me do the last verse.
You want to sit on my lap while I read?
No. If it's all right, I think I'd like to stand next to your chair while you read. And you take my arm.
While Grandpa Bill gets settled into his chair with Granddaughter standing next to him and his hand taking her arm, we have to wait a few minutes for the conclusion of this week's
Blind Justice.
I've been reading recently about retinitis pigmentosa, one of the leading causes for blindness. Has any progress been made in fighting that disease?
I think that's a great question for Dr. Bill. Let's talk with him about this.
It's time for Insights with Dr. Bill.
This is Dr. Bill. What's on your mind?
Dr. Bill, Bob and I were wondering about retinitis pigmentosa. Has anything been done that might eventually treat that disease?
Eventually may not be that far in the future.
Really? You mean some things are possible now?
Right now, through the Foundation Fighting Blindness. A very good friend of mine, Ed Summers, was telling me about some great research breakthroughs with this disease. Why don't I let him tell you about that organization and some of its accomplishments himself?
20 years ago, back in around 1990, the Foundation started working with people just in early research for gene therapies. It took a long time to develop that technology, but we started a clinical trial back in 2008. I think they had about 12 participants to test a gene therapy for an aggressive form of retinitis pigmentosa called Leber's congenital amaurosis, LCA. LCA affects kids. Typically, it'll cause blindness before your teenage years. Many of the people in this trial experienced improvements in their vision, and the improvements had sustained for years. There's one boy. His name is Corey Haas. He was about 9 years old when he took this gene therapy treatment in one eye. And at that time, he was using a cane to get around. And, you know, he couldn't play baseball. He couldn't ride his bike and things like that. After this gene therapy treatment, he is now sitting at the front of the class, not using assistive technology anymore. He's playing on a Little League baseball team. He's riding his bike with his friends because this gene therapy has restored his sight, and it's great stuff. The big challenge for Foundation Fighting Blindness for the next few years is to find the funds to take this, what we learned from this one gene therapy trial for LCA, and then start clinical trials on retinitis pigmentosa, retinal schisis, and a host of other degenerative retinal diseases. It's a really exciting time in the research area.
Wow, that really is exciting.
You know, I've been thinking.
Careful, Bob. It could become habit-forming.
What?
Never mind. What were you thinking about?
Well, I was thinking that those kinds of accomplishments really do fit in with the title of our little episodes that we call Blind Justice. Blind Justice. I've always related it to the statue that often stands outside the courthouses, but it really goes a lot farther than that, doesn't it?
Maybe I can help with that, too. And let's start with the statue, because Richard and I were just talking about the statue and its origins.
I thought it had something to do with Greek mythology, but Dr. Bill told me it was much older than that.
The image of a woman holding a sword and scales representing justice, is of mythological origins, but the source is Egyptian and dates back to the early part of the 3rd millennium BCE. The name of the goddess is Muat, and she carried neither a sword nor set of scales.
What she did carry was a staff of authority and an Ankh cross. That's a cross with the loop on top of it. This has two meanings. Sure. One is that she was a principal deity, and the other that she represented life. She also wore an ostrich feather, which represented truth.
This gives a very interesting picture about what people 4,000 years ago thought about justice. It was an integral part of life, and the picture of Muat didn't need a blindfold. Life needed justice.
Later on, the Greeks also adopted this idea. The goddess Themis became the representation of divine order, law, and custom. Her daughter, Dike, became the representation of justice. This passed on to the Romans in the figure of the goddess Justitia.
Because of the Romans, the goddess became identified with the blindfold. But many sculptors didn't use it because they felt that the feminine form automatically assumed impartiality. They felt that the blindfold was redundant.
I kind of like the idea of a blindfold. It gives a feeling that, well, justice depends on what truly is, not what it appears to be.
I agree. I've been asked to speak to children about my blindness, and they ask a lot of questions. One of the most asked is about what is attractive to me.
Good point. When you're sighted, you have preconceptions about what is pleasing and what is not. And we make decisions based on what we see.
Yeah. No matter what I look like, I'm a pretty nice guy.
Can we vote on that? No, Bob. You are much better than what we might have expected. But that's what I mean. What's attractive to me is not what someone looks like. It's how someone is and behaves and treats others. That's what makes someone attractive.
It would be pretty poor to go around deciding who was nice and who wasn't just by appearance. And the same thing applies to justice.
So, much more than just a statue.
And even an old TV program?
Yeah. Blind justice is a pretty good idea, isn't it?
Maybe even a great insight.
Especially if it can produce research ending a disease like retinitis pigmentosa.
And so ends another episode of Insights with Dr. Bill. Conversations. The voices of TRRS.
We have the privilege today of interviewing Tanya Hillard. Tanya is a brand new volunteer with Triangle Radio Reading Service, and for me, that's exciting. Tanya, welcome to the Triangle Radio Reading Service family.
Thank you, Bill.
Tell me a little about yourself, your background, your interest, how you got involved with Triangle Radio Reading Service.
Well, I got involved with Triangle Radio Reading Service by a friend, Tim Therrington, who asked me to read with him a long time ago, and I just tonight had the privilege and opportunity to read with him on the radio. So it was very exciting. And a little bit about me, I'm a mother of two children, a son and a daughter. I have a grandchild, and I'm a quilter and knitter. I actually teach quilting and knitting. So I'm a busy mom, lots of little hobbies, and I'm actually in the field of brain injury.
You work in that field?
I do.
Do you work in a hospital or are you in private practice?
No, sir. I've been working in the publishing field.
Oh.
Where we publish information on brain injury.
Tell our listeners about your first experience of reading.
Okay, well, today was my first day reading, so I have been super excited about this all week. Been looking forward to doing this with Tim for a while, so I was excited. Now, I have to admit to you that I was a little bit nervous in that my friend Tim, who is a school teacher and has a wonderful voice for the radio, sits next to me and reads so beautifully, and here I am, a Southern girl with a Southern accent, and all I kept thinking was, oh my goodness, these listeners are going to say, where did they get this girl? But once I got started, it was so easy to just kind of read the articles to the people. It was like I was thinking I was just reading to Tim beside of me, or even my daughter. She and I read to each other all the time, so I just kind of just melted into it a little bit.
You know, that's the most consistent thought that I have heard since I've been doing these interviews, is that our readers are encouraged to think of the microphone as a person. And when you think of the microphone as a person, it adds a different dimension.
You're right. I have to say that was said to me before I started, is to think of the microphone as a person, which then made it a little bit more personal. But I also thought of all the people I've met along the way in brain injury who have sight impairment and double vision, and all those wonderful people that I've had the opportunity to speak to and talk to and work with. And I thought, if they are sitting on the other end, I would be so honored to read to them. So it made it a whole lot easier for me, I think, if I could just think of it as real people and real faces of people that I've met along the way.
You've already answered an upcoming question. I was going to ask you if you had ever known another blind person, or if you had ever known a blind person before tonight. I actually had the privilege of interviewing one of our readers who was very enthusiastic about what she was doing, but had never sat down with a blind person.
Although you got to give that person credit, because although they don't know someone who's blind, they're still out there reaching to people and giving them a very practical thing, which is information from the newspaper and letting them hear what's going on locally, internationally, nationally. I think that's really wonderful. We just get out there and do our part. I think that's great.
Yes, I agree with you.
Thank you so much for having me. It's been a pleasure. So you guys are doing a great job, and thank you for letting me come in tonight and work with you guys.
Well, thank you, Tanya. It's been a pleasure to meet you.
Thanks, Bill.
We also have Debbie Schultz with us. Debbie, tell us a little about yourself.
Well, I've lived in North Raleigh for the past 8 years. I moved here in 2004 from New Jersey, the northern area of New Jersey, called Bergen County, right outside New York City.
And how about your educational background?
My beloved alma mater, Penn State, that's where I went to school. And I now have 3 children, 2 of whom are at the University of Georgia, and 1 is a high school senior and who will be applying to college in the next 2 months.
And while you were at college, what was your major?
Business. I actually got a bachelor's degree in marketing, which I have not used since the day I graduated in 1979.
And where did you make use of your business expertise?
My husband is an orthopedic surgeon. He currently works at Duke. He actually volunteers at the VA hospital twice a week. He gave up private practice in New Jersey when we moved here. So I did work for him up north for many years managing his office.
And what keeps you busy today?
Well, I like to work out a lot. I go to the Rex Wellness Center near my home in Wakefield, and I'm still busy with my high schooler, who, as I said, will be applying to college this fall. And, of course, I come to this radio station, this wonderful place where I've met so many great people, and I do my broadcast once a week.
And how did you become acquainted with us?
I actually read an article in the paper, the News and Observer. I did want to volunteer, and this just seemed like a perfect opportunity for me. I called, came in, I interviewed, and I started off at Triangle Radio Reading Service, reading the newspaper. I would come in whenever they needed a volunteer in a spot usually where a substitute was needed. And then they asked me if I wanted to read from Time Magazine. So that broadcast is available to you, the listener, via podcast. Just go to our website, TRRS, and click on the right where it says podcast, and then click again under Time Magazine, and I hope you will listen to me.
Do you have any favorite articles that you read out of Time Magazine?
I actually like, believe it or not, the pop culture segment, because I end up discussing those with my 17-year-old, and I'm very interested in the political articles because obviously our election is in 2 months. Milestones are very interesting to read about who's unfortunately passed away or different things that have happened in society. so I really like the whole magazine.
One last question. As you think about your listeners, is there anything personally you'd like to say to them?
Just that this has been a wonderful experience for me. I love this reading service, and I do hope that you will find me via podcast and listen. And please do call in if you have any comments or suggestions, negative or positive. I would love to hear from you, and you can contact the radio station anytime to let us know what you think. And the telephone number is 919-832-5138. So please do call.
Debbie, thank you very much for spending some time with us today.
Thank you. It was my pleasure.
It's time again for the TRRS Theater on the Air with Bill McClure and Abby Lewis with another episode of
Blind Justice.
We return to the retirement home with Bill McClure and Abby Lewis just in time to hear Grandpa and Abby read his poem.
Are you comfy in your chair, Grandpa?
Yes, I am. And I'll take your arm while I read.
And I get to recite the last verse.
We raced across the schoolyard so many years ago. Impossible all by myself. Changes I could not know. So you held out your arm, then crossed the fields we'd run. We did it neath the moon and stars. Likewise, a warming sun. Oh, we had our share of trips and bumps, but never did they harm, since it was you who'd choose the course, and I would choose your arm. Then came city traffic lights, yellow, red, and green. Away we'd go, through all the snarls and the troubles left unseen. Cars would stop, cars would go, traveling by so fast. Before we knew their coming, we realized they'd passed. Forget the honks. Ignore the yells. Their noise caused no alarm, since you were there beside me, and I held on to your arm. A date, a dance. Oh, should I go? Which way am I to turn? There seemed so much for me to know. How simple it was to learn. I took your arm, and you took mine. Across the floor we'd glide, sometimes fast and sometimes slow, but always side by side. How easy it was! And then to find such fun, such joy, a charm-filled life, when you reach out and touch a waiting arm. Then graduation. I was so proud. I heard them call my name. I strode up to the platform. On to that stage I came. Not a smile did I see that day, but I felt them all the same. A briefest silence followed, then again they spoke my name. I had done it, yes, but not alone. Beside, I felt you warm. One hand grasped my diploma, the other caressed your arm. Then one day, quite unexpectedly, she came into my life. When she offered me her elbow, a house, a home, a wife. What to do? Where to go? What would the future hold? Would we be able to survive? Her arm, the story's told, through grocery trips and bills to pay, tended furnaces to keep us warm. What a joy it's been through all these years to reach out and take your arm. Oh, through the years were many friends who've spent some time with me, and from that arm that I could feel, there was care that I could see. We've shared business and pleasure, we've shared joy and also care. You didn't even have to speak. I knew that you were there. I dared go on each and every day, a future without alarm. Because you were there beside me and offered me your arm.
The story is not ended here, one more voice before we go, and you must hear it now, if the truth you wish to know. I am one of many friends whose arm there was to touch, to cross a street, to climb a stair, to talk to and the such. It may not be seen by those who saw the many open doors, though there were times you held my arm, so many more, when I needed yours.
Did you do that from memory?
Yes. Mom and Dad have a copy of it at home, and I took it into my room and read it a lot.
You liked it?
Yes. It was nice to think about all the things you were able to do, because someone offered to be there to help.
It would be a very cold world if you didn't have friends to share with.
Yeah, I know.
Without friends, you wouldn't have anyone to come to your sleepovers. And there wouldn't be anyone to scream with when someone turned out the lights.
Grandpa, that was scary.
Maybe, but would you do that to somebody who wasn't your friend?
No, I wouldn't. You know, Grandpa, I just realized that friends aren't there just for you. You're also there for them.
That's right.
So all the time that friends are helping you, you are helping them too?
That's what friends do.
Grandpa, is it terrible being blind?
Well, it may be inconvenient sometimes, but it's certainly not terrible. I believe that God put every one of us on earth for a purpose. For some of us, it takes eyesight. For some of us, it doesn't. I believe that God gives each of us what we need to try and make this world a better place. You know, I used to be a piano tuner. I didn't go into somebody's home just to work on a piano. I went in to be of service to those people. If I could leave and they felt better about life, then I was successful.
They depended on you.
Yes, they did.
But they also trusted you.
I did my best.
Sort of like when you take somebody's arm.
Sort of.
Grandpa, I'd like to sit in your lap now.
Okay.
You know something? You're kind of like my old pink baby.
How's that?
You may be a bit wrinkled, but I still love you.
It may be nice to be a brand new pink baby, but it's also very comfortable being an old pink baby. Time for another story?
Not today, Grandpa. That poem was written about me, wasn't it?
That poem was written quite a while ago.
But it was still written about me.
Why do you think that?
You really trust me, don't you?
Yes, I do, Abby.
That's why I know your poem was written about me.
And so we leave Grandpa Bill and his granddaughter enjoying the very best of
Blind Justice.
And another visit back to the Governor Moorhead School with Myra DeBruhl.
This little story happened also at the State School for the Blind in Raleigh, and I was still in Cook Cottage, and I was still going to Pullen Memorial Baptist Church, walking to church every Sunday. A lot of us went to the church. I remember that Janice Fan did, and I did, and Barbara Taylor, Laverne Cheek. Anyway, I'm the chaperone, and we're off to church on Sunday morning. We always sat in the balcony. Now, I don't know if I can help you understand, if you don't go to that church, what that balcony is like, but it has a balcony that faces the front, like all balconies do, and it also has two side balconies that kind of look across the congregation. Well, we always sat in one of those side balconies, and we always left during the last song, because on Sundays, we had fried chicken, and the people with the cabs always got the drumsticks, and I really wanted a drumstick, so I thought if we left during the last song, maybe we'd get back in time. We had gone to church this particular Sunday morning, and we had done our usual thing, and then the time comes, and it's time to go out. And you go down all these steps. There's a step, of course, at each row, just like in a movie theater or something. And we're going down the row, and for some reason, I decided to let go of Janice's hand, and I pushed the other girls into the row where we were standing and left Janice to go clomping down all the steps and all the rows of the balcony all by herself. She went all the way to the bottom of that balcony where, of course, she found the rails, and she stood there. I don't know what kind of names that she was probably calling me, but she stood there, knowing Janice as I did. She probably just kind of leaned forward ever so slightly. I hadn't been laughing so hard, I could probably have heard the congregation going, but Janice turned around, and she came stomping back up every row that she had just been down, and it was wooden, because you could hear those heels. I heard every one of them, and she said, I'm going to kill her. I'm going to kill her. I'm going to kill her. Well, I grabbed her when she got to our row, and we went on out, and I thought that Janice might never forgive me. The next day, I got called in by the principal. He said, I can't believe you did that. And I said, what? You did that on purpose, and people, son, you got reported, and if anything else happens at church again, you will not be a chaperone. I really wanted to be a chaperone. I said, now, Mr. Stow, now look at me. Do you really think I'd do that on purpose? And he said, no, frankly, I just can't believe that you would. Another story that happened while I was in Cook Cottage at the State School for the Blind in Raleigh, and it also happened at Pullen Memorial Baptist Church. Again, we went to the church, and I was trying to behave because I really wanted to be a chaperone. There was one Sunday, though, we were walking out, and you know when you went to Pullen, now I'm not trying to talk about the way anybody dressed or the styles, but then it was very fashionable to wear hats with flowers on. It looked like a flower garden from the balcony, or else it looked like just fur, tons and tons of fur and minks, because everybody seemed to wear minks and hats. I remember one Sunday on the way out the door, I took Laverne's hand and I put it up on a lady's shoulder and I pulled it all the way down to the end of the hem of that mink, and I did it again and again and again, like she was rubbing a nice furry animal. This lady grabbed our hands and I saw that hat going to fall off her head. She was shaking it so hard at us, and she said, don't they teach you girls anything out there at that school? And Laverne said, they try. They really do, ma'am, but Myra's a really slow learner. I'm glad we didn't get reported, because the next Sunday we went back to sit in our balcony one more time. We're sitting up there and it's time to go home, and I reached over and took Laverne's little coat. It was a spring coat. I never will forget how it felt. It was silky feeling, and I put it on the other side of me. I don't know why or what I thought I was doing, but Laverne got to looking for her coat. Well, Janice was sitting on the other side of Laverne, and she thought she had hold of Laverne's coat, but she had Laverne's skirt tail, and she's pulling it up higher and higher and higher and higher. And Laverne's crinoline slip just all of a sudden just poked out like it's waving down at the congregation. And I gave Laverne her coat. I don't think I really did that one on purpose, but I don't think they believed me.
We can't leave without a visit from Professor Bill.
Right you are. It's time now for Outside the Box with Professor Bill. The problem. You were driving a bus, picking up passengers to take them from the Governor Moorhead School to the RLCB Center on Bush Street. You arrive at exactly 8 a.m. and pick up 17 passengers. Then you leave the grounds at 8:15, turning left onto Ash Street, go to Western, and turn right. Then ride onto Pullen, onto the NC State campus, and around the Rotary to the Arts Center. There you drop off two people and pick up five. You leave the Arts Center at 8:35. Then you go back to the Rotary up to Hillsboro and turn left. Continue on Hillsboro to Meredith College and turn right onto the grounds. At Meredith College, you let off one person and take on three. You leave Meredith at 8:45, back onto Hillsboro to the entrance of the Beltline, and turn right headed for 70. Go past Glenwood exit and proceed to Six Forks South and exit. Down Six Forks to Plantation and turn left, and then left again into the parking lot for the Triangle Radio Reading Service. At the studio, you let four people off and take six. You leave TRRS at 9:15, then back onto Plantation and left back onto Six Forks. Then go to Wake Forest Road and turn left. Go under the Beltline and turn right on Navajo. Go up Navajo to Bush Street, turn left, and then right into the parking lot at RLCB Center, arriving there at 9:30. There you let off all the remaining passengers.
Hold it right there. There is no problem and no need for any other questions. I have the answer.
If you've solved this already without even hearing the question, you really are thinking outside the box. Go ahead.
Okay, now, start with 17 people. That counts as a stop. Then, to the Arts Center. Stop two. Two people off and five on makes 20. Then to Meredith College for stop three. One off and three on. That makes 22. On to the Beltline to TRRS for stop number four. Four off and six on makes 24. And finally from TRRS to RLCB for stop number five. 24 people get off.
That's not the question.
Five stops were made. Now, don't stop me. I'm on a roll. 8 left turns and 8 right turns, including some that you didn't mention, but they had to be made. Total time for the trip is 90 minutes. And as you went past the old costume shop across from Meredith College, you'd have noticed that they are out of business.
I wouldn't have noticed, and I don't think any of the passengers would have noticed.
Well, why not? It was right across the street. All you had to do is look at the... Oh. Never mind.
You know, Bob, all your information is correct, but are you sure it's the right answer?
Well, of course. You heard all the information that Richard gave.
Right, but in an earlier Outside the Box segment, I told you about some problems that have all kinds of extra information that you don't need, and then you struggle with the red herrings and miss the real question.
Well, thank you, but I learned from that lesson. This time, I listened to all the information.
Except the question. Richard?
Thank you. The problem is, what is the name of the bus driver?
What is the name of the bus driver? How can we possibly know that?
I think Richard told you. What was the first thing he said in presenting the problem?
The problem is...
After that?
Oh. You're driving a bus... Oh. You're driving a bus. Me. I'm driving the bus.
Or whoever is solving the problem.
So, my answer is Bob.
Good for you. You did a fine job driving.
Another solution, thanks to creative thinking from... Outside the Box.
One last thought. A broadcaster in San Francisco used to end his programs with the comment, "Angels fly, because they take themselves lightly."
This is Bill McClure. Thank you for listening in to another edition of Take My Arm.
This is Richard Dunnigan. This program is intended for a print and visually impaired audience and is prepared with the assistance of print and visually impaired volunteers.
And this is Bob Martin. We invite your comments about this program and any of the programs that are being offered by TRRS. Please call us at 919-832-5138. We'd love to hear from you. Also, if you could assist us in keeping our programming on the air with a pledge of financial assistance, please call the Triangle Radio Reading Service. The number is 919-832-5138. Until next time,
goodbye.